Any questions?
Yeah.
Ah, you too. Okay. You first then. Okay.
I wonder about this when you talked about Sankarta and there is Easter about faith and surrender. And do you think it's very important to find a spiritually developed teacher to practicing surrender? Or is it you can practicing surrender to everything?
Mm.
Or can you talk about this?
Mm. Yeah. Just thinking about where to begin with this one. Lots of different strands to it. If you have got a spiritual teacher who you revere, who you revere, you reverence, Gaurava is the word, Gaurava, which means if you believe that that spiritual teacher has deep insight, then that's a great opportunity just to surrender to that person. Probably not very wise to surrender someone who's not wise, because you end up doing all sorts of things which, you know, you don't really need or shouldn't do. But in our movement, before I talk about our movement, this idea of having a spiritual teacher is a personal spiritual teacher who you see and you're in great contact with. That's not always been the case in Buddhism. That's seen as important. So if you go back to the time of the Buddha, it wasn't seen as important that you had a spiritual teacher who you were in contact with all the time. Yeah. You had a preceptor, and you kept in touch with your preceptor. But part of the rules of the preceptor-disciple relationship was the preceptor has to point out faults in the disciple, but the disciple has to point out faults in the preceptor as well. So it's not quite like the same as this guru-disciple relationship which we often think of. So I would say that the guru-disciple relationship is probably strongest in the Tibetan traditions, where the disciple has to try to see their teacher as the Buddha. Yeah, their teacher may not be enlightened, but it's important the disciple sees them as being enlightened. You also get it to a certain extent in Zen, don't you? You get the teacher and the disciple. But it's not an absolutely necessary way of living the spiritual life to have a teacher-disciple relationship. Many of the Buddha's disciples, there's a lovely story in the Pali Canon in Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha, if I've told you this story before, let me know and I'll stop. But the Buddha is wandering alone. He hardly ever does that, but he's completely alone, wandering. And he comes to this small village and he asks a potter, you know, someone who makes pots, can I stay in your shed, your workshop? And he said, well, yeah, you, from my point of view, you can, but there's already someone in there, so you need to ask them. And the Buddha goes and knocks on the door, and there's a bhikkhu, one of his disciples, in there. And but this disciple has never met the Buddha before, and the Buddha's never met the disciple. So the Buddha, it's a lovely story, the Buddha says to him, may I stay here, you know? And the disciple, not knowing who this is, says, yeah, there's plenty of room, you could sleep over there and I'll sleep here. So they do. They get their bedding ready and everything, but they decide they're going to meditate. And they meditate more or less through the whole night. And the Buddha thinks, this guy's really good, actually. What if I question him? So he says, who's your teacher? And he says, the Buddha. And he starts going on about how great the Buddha is, the enlightened one, fully enlightened one. And then comes a bit of humour, because the Buddha said, and this Buddha, the great one, the fully enlightened one, the brilliant guy, have you ever met him? And he said, no. So now they're in a situation where the Buddha is his teacher and he's with him and he doesn't know. So the Buddha doesn't say, well, I'm the Buddha. he just starts teaching him the Dharma. He starts teaching him. So the rest of the night he's teaching him the Dharma. And eventually, sometime early morning, the disciple suddenly realizes, this is the Buddha. The first time he's ever met him. But he's gone a long, long way, you know, before he met the Buddha. So it's not really essential to have a teacher-disciple, close teacher-disciple relationship, which is good for us, isn't it? Because most of us don't have that. So in our movement, what replaces that is the Sangha as a whole, yeah? So in Subhuti's latest paper, the superpersonal, second from latest paper now, A Superpersonal Force, he talks about the importance of serving the Dharma. Serving the Dharma, just doing whatever you can to help propagate the Dharma. You might be a good teacher, so teach. You may not be able to teach, so help other people teach. Fundraise, do things for the... And help each other in the Sangha. And I find that a really, really good practice, just to do whatever.
It's a substitute for...
For the teacher. For teacher. Yeah. So your teacher is the Sangha. Yeah. Now, you know, who knows the Sangha we've got around us? There may be no one who's got really deep insight. But as a whole, there are a bunch of people who are trying to practice the Dharma. And when you're with a bunch of people who are practicing the Dharma, you can change the way you relate to them. So our immediate way of relating to people is to think of ourselves almost first. You know, sometimes we put others first, but often we think of ourselves as being... We experience ourselves as being the most important person in the universe, basically, don't we? That's our kind of basic experience, comes from evolution, the evolutionary brain. You know, we're really important, you know, and the world revolves around us. If we were a play, we would be the main person in the play or the film, and we'd be in every single scene, and everyone else would be subsidiary actors around us, yeah. That's our life, isn't it? We're the most important person. And it's a brilliant opportunity in the Sangha to be not the most important person and to actively practice that, actively practice being the least important person, perhaps. So, you know, if someone says they'd like to go on retreat but they can't afford it, and you can afford to go on retreat, and you were going to go on the retreat, but you say, look, you go in my place. Yeah, just go, I'll pay for you, you go. You need it more than I do. And you've given up the self. You've surrendered to the greater good, to someone else's benefit. So there's massive amount of opportunities to practice surrendering. You could say, you could just surrender to the universe. Yeah, let the universe do what it wants, it will anyway. So just, you know, give yourself up to the universe. In later Pure Land Buddhism, with Shinran and Honen, the late Japanese strong other power form of Buddhism, there's this idea that you're a lotus blossom that falls, you fall, right? You fall into the water, and then the water carries you. Yeah? But you have to fall first. Yeah? So let go. Let go of self-clinging. Let go of what you want. Let go of your importance in the world. Let all that go. Fall, and then the stream carries you too.
I was thinking about pure awareness and pure land.
Ah.
Is it about the same, or is there a difference?
Well, there's a connection. There is a connection, pure. Pure is the connection. And pure is a very interesting word in Buddhism. Shuddha. Yeah. What does shuddha mean? So shuddha or shuddha in Buddhism is pure, but it doesn't just mean pure in the ethical sense. It means pure of selfhood. Yeah, pure of the idea that there's a self at the core of your being. So purity in Buddhism has this this on a twofold meaning. It has a mundane meaning, which is ethically pure, but it also means transcendentally pure in a way. It's you're pure of the mistaken view that you have a self. Yeah. So pure awareness is the practice of being aware, but without this idea of a self that's being aware. Yeah, just pure awareness without selfhood, without tying it to some idea that there's someone being aware. Yeah, that's pure awareness. Pure land is the externalization of that awareness. So that's why the pure land is seen in the Pure Land text as a place somewhere else. But actually, as you practice, you realize it's here, but it's that your mind either sees the world as impure, that is full of selfhood and substantiality, or as pure. A pure mind sees a pure land. So that's the connection between the two. What that means is that we can enter into the pure land at any time, at any place. So when you're in a state of pure awareness, you're also in the pure land at the same time.
That's Sangharakshita, that's the spiritual system.
Yeah.
And the spiritual
depth. Yeah.
Can you compare that too? Can you compare the pure land with spiritual rebirth?
Oh, yeah, the pure land. I've been saying recently that I think we're turning into a pure land sect. Yeah. Because Bhante and Subhuti have been talking or writing quite a lot about reimagining the Buddha, placing the Buddha as central. And in one of their papers, they talk about Bhante is musing on Amitabha. You know, why Amitabha? And he goes back to the Gaurava Sutta from the Pali Canon, the early text, where the Buddha, just a few days after his enlightenment, he says, who can I look up to now? Who can I revere? Gaurava means reverence. Who can I revere? And he looks around the whole universe, and there's no one higher than him. There's no one more enlightened than him. And what he says, if you don't have anyone or anything to revere, that is a cause of suffering. So he wants someone to revere, but he can't find anyone. So then he says, okay, I'll revere the Dharma. So the Buddha reveres, you know, reveres the Dharma that he discovered. And Bhante, musing on this, says, in a way, you could say that Amitabha and the other transcendent Buddhas, Amitabha represents the Buddha beyond the Buddha. Yeah. So Amitabha is, you could say, universal Buddhahood, whereas the Buddha is Buddhahood as express within a human being. I've been joking really that we're turning into a Pure Land sect. You've got reimagining the Buddha, and then you've got a supernatural force, and you've got Karma Niyama and Dharma Niyama. I'm sorry those of you who aren't used to all these terms, it's a little bit technical, but Karma Niyama is self-power and Dharma Niyama is other power. So it's all there. You know, you could reimagine our movement in Pure Land terms very easily. But I have mentioned this, but I haven't gone into it. I've identified in the shorter Sukhavi Vyuha Sutra, I've identified a fivefold path. First one is pranidhana. What did I say pranidhana was? Heartfelt desire. So that's the first one. You need a heartfelt desire, pranidhana, to be reborn in the pure land, or to have a pure mind, yeah, to gain enlightenment. The second is ethical practice. The Buddha says that you won't be reborn with only a few roots of goodness, kusala dharma, kusala mula. In other words, you need a lot of roots of ethical practice before you. And then the third one is meditation. In the Pure Land, in the text, it's particularly meditation on Amitabha's name. You remember I was talking about that, an undistracted mind, undistractedly absorbed in Amitabha's name. So that's, you know, if we widen it outside of this particular text, you could say that's meditation. And then you die. And I think in the text it means, you know, literal death. So you die with Amitabha's name in your mind, yeah? Then you die, and then you're reborn in the Pure Land. I don't know what's funny about that. Rebirth in the Pure Land. That's the fivefold path in the text. Now, it's very easy to see how that relates to us, isn't it? Going for refuge to the three jewels. Ethics, meditation. Meditation here, you could say these two represent between them integration and positive emotion. And then spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. It's all there in the text. Yeah. Yeah.
Standards.
Yeah.
For example, I work with stress patients, and they are often have very high ethical standards, and they do a lot for their employers, and they always say yes to, requests and so on, and they end up sick from stress.
Indeed. Yeah.
And I also think if you're in a or just in your workplace or with your friends, you're kind of expected to kind of stand up for yourself or to express your opinions, and sometimes to kind of, you need to set boundaries for others who kind of walk over you. And if you kind of live by those standards and you're very you put yourself, like you said, you put yourself least or kind of last.
You can, yeah.
Could you elaborate on?
Well, I'll try to. Yeah. It's a difficult situation because what I said was you can surrender to the sangha, but you have to be careful of not surrendering to certain people because they will eat you all up, and there'll be nothing left for you at the end of the day. So you need to be really careful of that. So an important aspect of Buddhist training is wisdom as well. And you need to discernment, wise attention. Manisakara, I think, isn't it? Manisakara? Anyway, wise attention is a very important thing that we need to develop in Buddhism, and making wise decisions. So not only generosity, that's good, but also wisdom. Because if you only had generosity and not wisdom, you're going to burn out. There'll be nothing left of you in a little while. So in order to save the world, you need to look after yourself. You know, when you go on aeroplane trips and there's a person at the front telling you what to do, you know, there's the exits and so on. And then if the oxygen masks come down, what do you have to do if the oxygen masks come down? What's the instruction? First, and then you help the others. Because if you help the others first, you pass out. You know, you do the, and now, you know, someone's got to help you now. Yeah. So you put the oxygen mask on first. It's important that you need to look after yourself. You could still do that in the spirit of surrendering, in that I will give myself to the world, But in order for that to be of any use, I have to be healthy, happy, energized, wise, kind. I have to be able to give. Now, if I give everything now in the next few months and I've got nothing to give, and then someone else has to look after me, and what use is that going to be to the world? So you need that wisdom, you know, to know when is the time to give yourself up for someone else's benefit, and when is the time to hold back and say, wait a minute now, if I do this extra thing now, what effect, long-term effect is it going to have on me? So wisdom. Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to Padmasuriya about, I can't pronounce her name, Professor Maria...
Wasburn.
Do you know her?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's got the exhaustion funnel idea, hasn't she? You know the exhaustion funnel? Ah, it's very, very useful from this point of view. Very good for Buddhists, because Buddhists are very good at giving themselves up to situations and then getting burnt out, especially in our movement. Starts off like that, that's your life. And everyone's life these days is really full, isn't it? You know, you've got your work, your family, your social life, maybe you keep fit, maybe you go to the gym a few times a week, you see your friends, and it's all, you know, lots and lots of things. You can just about keep it together, right? And then something happens in your life. So you, I don't know, someone at work is off sick, or they leave and, you know, the department says, we can't afford to employ someone to take their place, so we'll have to share their job out amongst ourselves. So now you've got more work to do, yeah? Or a parent or a grandparent becomes ill and you have to go to hospital a lot. So now you've got this extra thing. And you can't do everything, yeah? So you have to drop something from your life. What do you drop?
Something nice.
Something that nourishes you, yeah? It won't let anybody else down. So let's say you stop going to the gym, yeah? So now your life is a little bit smaller. And what's missing is the thing that nourishes you. So at the end of that week, you've got the same situation, grandparents still in hospital, still a lot of work to do, but you haven't nourished yourself as much as you did before. So now you feel more depleted, so something else has got to go. What's that? Reading a novel. Yeah, you haven't got time to read that novel, so a bit smaller. You see where we're going? And it keeps on going like this until all there is work, housework, and visiting that aged parent. Yeah, you ever anybody in that situation?
Yeah.
And it's just like there's nothing for you. It's all give, give, give. And according to Professor Eisberg, thank you. That's how people end up burnt out. Yeah, and when you're there, it's very hard to get back up there because you haven't got any energy. Yeah, even energy to do things for you. It's a really, really uphill struggle back there. So we Buddhists have to be very careful about this. Who are the kind of people who end up down there? The kind of people that you were talking about. High ethical standards. Yeah, always looking after other people. Will do something for someone else before they do it for themselves. Yeah, and you end up there. So Buddhists have to be very, very careful about this syndrome. This narrowing of life down to just hardly anything left. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the ego bit is a bit tricky here. And spiritual friendship strikes me as very important.
Mm-hmm.
To get somebody else's view. Because I could rationalise, well, it's too much for me. I need to go to the retreat, even though there is someone who maybe needed to go more than I, as you said before.
Yeah. So spiritual friendship's good because they can give you another angle on things. You don't have to believe what your spiritual friend says. You don't have to go by what they say, but it's just another angle, isn't it? It's just like, look at it this way, kind of thing. And it's good to get as much information as you can, isn't it? Feedback's always good because you don't have to believe it. Someone says, you're a bit selfish, Ratnaguna. We think, oh, am I? Didn't think I was. But it's interesting information, is it? Someone has experienced me as selfish, which is interesting. you know, interesting. Doesn't have to be true, but someone's experienced enlightenment. How has that happened? How is it that someone's experienced? Am I selfish? Maybe I'm a bit. Just makes you think, doesn't it?
And the Pure Land, because in a way, the Pure Land could be, or could seem a bit like escapist, something happy, joyous that you want to go to, you don't really want to be here in this
world. Yes, yeah. I did. I think in the history of Pure Land Buddhism, the Pure Land tradition has often been criticised by Buddhists of other schools for a couple of reasons, connected reasons. One is it can look very much like theism. So Amitabha can look very much like God, infinite life, yeah? And Sukhavati can look very much like heaven, yeah? And Pure Land Buddhists have been criticised for a naive understanding of Buddhism. They fought back, you know, by saying, well, the Pure Land isn't like that, you know. Rebirth is a no rebirth. There's no self that's been reborn, etc., etc. But connected with that is the idea of escapism. Now, there's a difference between escaping and escapism. Yeah. So escapism is when you try to escape something but to no avail. You can't actually escape. So it's a kind of fantasy of escaping. You try to escape into a fantasy world. And people do that a lot, don't they? Daydreaming, you know. Little escapisms, you know, you see someone just thinking about, you know, something completely nothing to do with the way their life is, and there's this kind of escapist fantasy. So we need to be careful of that, obviously, in talking about the Pure Land, because it can lend itself to that kind of escapist fantasy. How do you counter that? Well, I suppose you counter it by using all of the Buddhist teachings. You know, we don't live in a pure land; we live in an impure land. That's the fact of the matter. If you take this idea of pure lands and impure lands literally, we live in an impure land. We're not in a pure land, actually. So, to think in terms of living in a pure land in this land, you could see as escapist. So, what is it like to be here in this land? So you really, as I said in the first day, I think you don't get to the Pure Land by opting out of this land. I don't like this. Get me out of here. What's it? Do you have Star Trek?
Beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah, it's not beam me up, Scotty. Yeah, you can't beam up out of here into some other place. This is where you live. I don't know if you've noticed this, but do you have a sense of you've got two lives going on at the same time? You've got, well, maybe more, yeah. You've got the way you think things should be, and then you've got the way things are. Yeah. And there's often a discrepancy between them, usually. So, you know, you walk into a room and you end up having a conversation, you're not happy with it, and immediately part of you thinks, this shouldn't be happening. You know, this is not the way it should have happened like this. We go to a retreat and it's not as good as you thought it was going to be, and you think, this shouldn't, you know, I've paid money and this should be like this, and it's not, it's like this. Or you behave badly in a situation and now you think, I shouldn't have done that. That's not really me. I should have done this. This is what really should... Do you get that idea? You've got these parallel lives. The real one and the fantasy one. Yeah. So it's a bit like that, isn't it? So what Buddhism the Buddhist practice tries to get you to do is really live in the real one, not the fantasy one, the real one. And so mindfulness, you know, noticing anything that happens, noticing the good, the bad, skillful, the unskillful, the pleasant, the unpleasant, just noticing it as it comes and just really being with it is the way to counter that kind of escapist tendency that some of us have, actually. Yeah. Does that answer? Well, of course, I suppose the question arises there, what is reality? I've said this is an impure land, but the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, another Buddhist text, Mahayana text, Shariputra has a thought. There's the Buddha there, and Shariputra has a thought. Why isn't this a pure land, actually? Why hasn't the Buddha made this into a pure land? I suppose he must have an impure mind then. The Buddha must have an impure mind if this is an impure land. And the Buddha reads his thoughts and he outs him. And he says, it's not because of my impure mind that this land is impure. It's actually a pure land. And he touches the ground with his foot, his big toe, and Shariputra suddenly sees everything as a pure land, just for a few seconds. And then he touches it again, it goes back to the way it was. He says, the reason you think this is an impure land is the impurity of your own mind. Yeah. So, again, we're back to this idea of purity, not as an ethical thing, but as the way you view yourself and life. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're closer to the way things are, aren't you? That's what we're trying to get to. We're just trying to see the way things are. And because we're unenlightened, we kind of think that if we saw the way things really were, they would just look just like they do now, except we'd understand. Yeah. But actually, the way we look at things is very dependent upon our state of mind. So the world would look differently. There's a wonderful documentary with David Hockney. Andrew Marr, the political commentator, is a friend of David Hockney's. There's this documentary. I've been unable to get it on YouTube or anything, unfortunately. So it's all from memory, but David Hockney is up in the north of England painting over a year this one bit of countryside, which is a lane, a little country lane, like the one going into the forest there, with trees on either side of it. He calls it the tunnel. He goes there every day for a year, paints it in different weathers, different seasons. So you've got lots and lots of paintings. So there's this little lane with trees. And they're at this lane, and David Hockney's painting. And Andrew Marr talks about, he mentions the sky, which at the moment is grey. Andrew Marr thinks, and he talks about, and David Hockney says, well, what colour is that? And he says, it's grey. He said, it's not actually, if you look closely. And he points out that there are lots of colours there. There is a grey, there's a kind of pinkiness, there's a slight blue, there's a white over there. And suddenly you see the sky very differently, just because David Hockney sees. His whole life is seeing what's really there. And as you know, if you ever talk to an artist, maybe some of you are artists, there's a lot more there than most of us see. So it's the same with the Dharma, really. It's not only that when you're enlightened you see clearly, you see differently. Yeah. You see imaginatively.
So that's the connection, sensorium.
That's the sensorium connection, yeah. You don't fly out of this life and this world, you go into it. Yeah.
So what do you mean with not seeing clearly? Not only seeing clearly,
but, or you could say, what is clarity? You know, this definition of prasada faith, serene faith, is clear, lucid, very, very clear, pellucid, bright. Yeah. So when you see clearly, there's a certain brightness that happens as well. You probably experience this sometimes when you meditate. Often when you meditate, you just go through the hindrances and planning, and at the end of it, there's no difference. You know, you're just the same you, except you've been sitting there just churning away. But sometimes that doesn't happen, doesn't it? Sometimes you do get really concentrated. It's just suddenly, wow, different state of mind, and happy, joyful, warm. And then you open your eyes and you're in a different world. A different world. So we can't help but assume that everyone's living in the same world as us. You know, the same trees we see, everyone else sees the same trees. But actually, we probably see different trees. David Hockney definitely sees the world differently than I usually see it. Definitely.
Sometimes I find myself to have a conscious determination, sort of.
Ah.
Buddhism is what I strive for.
Yeah.
And I don't feel it as a heartfelt desire.
Mm.
But maybe that is of use as well, or could you elaborate on?
Effort is a difficult concept, I think, perhaps for Westerners. I have a friend who used to be in the audio, Arya Deva. He's resigned now, German. Lovely, lovely man, very, very dedicated to the spiritual life. And he started going to America to meditate with Joseph Goldstein on his 3-month-long retreats. And I was talking to Arya Deva once about this, and we were talking about making effort and so on, and he said, you know, in America with the Insight Meditation Society, they've got this whole thing of the way you make an effort is no effort. You know, you don't make effort, you just sit there not making any effort. And Arya Deva questioned Joseph about this. He said, well, you know, when you read the Pali text, there's loads of words for striving. You know, like the Eskimos are supposed to have 32 words for snow. I reckon the Buddha had about 32 words for striving, making effort. Lots of different words for that. There's a lot about making effort, striving, you know, putting forward energy towards the goal. There's a lot of that. So Arya Deva brought that up. He said, well, you know, the Buddha talks about making effort and you're talking about not making effort. And Joseph said, yeah, that's true. He said, when I'm in Burma teaching Burmese people, I talk about effort because they just go, oh, yeah, that sounds good. And then they don't make any effort. Yeah, they just, oh, that's a good idea. Yeah, and then they just carry on the way they were before. When he talks to Westerners about effort, they start going, oh, right, okay, right. And they really sort of like, right, sit there. You know this Zen thing, like this. And we don't get anywhere. You know, we're so trying to make effort, like muscular effort, really trying to make effort. We just get nowhere. So somehow we need to learn how to make effort in a relaxed, open, friendly, happy kind of way. There's a writer that I really like called Tom Hodgkinson, who wrote a book called How to Be Idle. And then he followed it up with another book called How to Be Free. Because once he'd written the book How to Be Idle, he realised that for him, idleness was freedom. And he's got this brilliant phrase, lonely striving. Yeah. He said a lot of Westerners get into this lonely striving Do you know? You get that idea? Where you're striving away, but you're all on your own, you know, like this, and life's really tough. You know, you get this feeling, don't you, with Westerners, life is really tough. And you think, why? Why is it so tough? It's because what we put ourselves through, isn't it? So how do we get from where we are now to heartfelt desire without it being lonely striving? Yeah, how do we get there? So when you say your experience, I recognise that. And I don't know you well enough to know whether what you said is a good thing. You know, while you don't feel the heartfelt desire, maybe the other thing, what did you call determined?
What I said, probably I could say something else, but I think it's a conscious determination.
Yeah, so they feel very different, don't they? Heartfelt desire and conscious determination feel different. What happens when you don't have a heartfelt desire? What should you do? Should you move to conscious determination? Or should you just let go completely and not do anything? That's the problem we often have, isn't it? I talked, was it yesterday or the day before, about my own crisis 10, 12 years ago. And part of that was lonely striving, the whole business of trying to get somewhere, you know. And I'd been practicing for about 25 years, and let's say enlightenment was that lamp over there. And I'd probably got about that far, you know, if that, just like, oh. And I'm 50 now, so, it's not going to happen, is it? It was very, very demoralising. And it's as if, I think part of what happened, I think, was I was putting forth energy, to use the Buddhist phrase, you know, striving, 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 but without the heartfelt desire of it, yeah. There was a little bit of heartfelt desire sometimes and a lot of the other at other times. And you can go on like that for a few years, depending on your personality type. You can go on that for like that for a few years, but eventually you come to a stop, and it's a very unpleasant place to be. It's a desert, actually. You end up in a desert, gasping for water. You can hardly breathe, you can hardly do anything. And for me, there was quite a lot of anger and resentment towards Bhante and the Buddhist path for putting me in this position, you know. And a feeling that I just wanted to be an ordinary person, a craving just to be an ordinary person, watching the telly, watching football, being out with a few friends, having a few beers. You know, I got this craving for that kind of thing. What was going on? I just built, you know, I just found myself in this place that I'd put myself in. No one else had put me in, I had done it. So we need to be very careful, I think, exhaustion funnel. We need to be very careful how we approach the Dharma. And that's why Sangha is so important, I think. Just be with your friends. Play, have fun, and practice within that context. You are the kind of person you are. And much as I'd like to be a spiritual hero like Milarepa, I'm not actually. I'm just a person. I'm just quite an ordinary kind of person. I've done my best, but it isn't brilliant, you know. But it's who I am, you know. And I'm not Bhante. I'm not these great spiritual heroes who we revere. I'm just an ordinary person. And most of us are, aren't we? Most of just ordinary persons who have come across the Buddhist path think, oh, that sounds really good. But then if we're not careful, we put ourselves in this position, the two lives, yeah? There's your real life and then there's the fantasy life. And then we start fantasizing about being this great spiritual practitioner. And now I've got to get up at 5 in the morning. And you need to be really careful about that. So my main message is enjoy life. Enjoy it. Enjoy living the spiritual life. Have a great time. When Bhante, Sangharakshita, before he was a Buddhist monk, he was in India looking for teachers, and all he could find was Hindu teachers. And he found one who, I can't remember his name now, but he just had a great time. And Bhante was telling him about, he was with his friend, wasn't he, Buddhapriya. Bhante was telling about their daily regime of getting up really early in the morning, meditating a lot and fasting. And this teacher said, don't do that. You know, enjoy yourself. And he used to laugh a lot and have a good time. So if we could just do that and then practice from that basis of enjoyment and love and affection, we would get somewhere, I think. But it would be heartfelt desire rather than conscious determination. And occasionally you need the conscious determination. It's an occasional recourse to that. But if it's the only thing, you're going to be running on empty. Do you have that phrase?
Yeah.
Running on empty. Until you stop. And then like, in the middle of nowhere, you know. Whoa! Yeah, yeah. Not a good place to be. Yeah, Sangha's marvellous, isn't it? Brilliant. What a fantastic thing it is that we can practice within the Sangha. Imagine trying to do this all on your own. I'd have given up 40 years ago. You know, I'd be doing something else now if I was all on my own. But, you know, just having a bunch of people around and having friends and just brilliant. Yeah. Enjoy it. If you enjoy it, you'll stick around. One of the reasons people leave the movement, resign from the order, maybe leave Buddhism, because they're having a horrible time. That's why. Who wants to have that, you know? You can do that for a week or two, can't you? But if it's like that for a year, it's just like, I don't want this. Yeah. I think the other thing that I've been thinking about is I used to be a musician. I wanted to be a classical guitarist, and I just wasn't good enough. And when you're not good enough, you try really, really hard to be good, and you really work at it. But in the end, I just wasn't good enough. Yeah. And it's a bit like the spiritual life, you know. I'm just not that great at it, you know. I know people who are really good at it, like really virtuoso musicians. You think, wow, that's brilliant. And I've tried to be like that, and I just not. Just can't do it. So accepting who you are, you know. Well, this is me, and these are my talents, and I'm not very good at this, I'm okay at that. But that's me, and I'm happy to practice within my own limitations, you know. We don't all have to be Nagarjunas and Atishas and Shinmans, you know. We're just who we are, and, you know. You know, if you want to play the piano, there's certain pieces you just can't play, you know. And other pieces you can. So play the pieces you can play and enjoy playing them.